From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It's been more than 5 years since the rallying anti-racist cry of Black Lives Matter went viral. Focused initially on violent episodes of police brutality and vigilante attacks against Black people, the movement then broadened as a critique of systematic and institutional racism in America. Today, we turn to the co-author of a new book intended as a guide for anti-racists, Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. My guest is Tehema Lopez-Bunyasi, Assistant Professor of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. Her co-author on the book is Candace Watts-Smith. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as I said, this has become a rallying cry. Black Lives Matter is something that has changed the conversation on how we view race and racism in America. Would you say, first of all, broadly speaking, that we're still in the beginnings of a movement that may have achieved a lot, but is still on its way?
I think that's a great question, and it's hard to know with movements, right? I mean, it's always that retrospect that we feel like we understand a movement better. I think what we've seen in this beginning here is with the help of social media, which was integral, is this framing of talking about Black life and the worth of Black life, which is, I think, it feels like a novel way to frame the issue because Black people have been dehumanized in this country for hundreds of years. And there have been very specified efforts often to eradicate that dehumanization in the efforts of abolition, in the efforts of reconstruction. And so now it's as if in a way that there's a kind of a totality here that we're talking about. It's not just about police brutality. It is about how Black people's life chances are shaped, right? And so what I think the movement is evolving towards is it has changed the way that we talk, just like you've mentioned. It's become a household name, right? Like people know what this idea is, or at least they're starting to think they do. And I think we're starting to see certain policy being implemented, and we're starting to see rallying around these messages, and we are starting to see a shift in sort of the, I don't know if I want to say radicalization, but I want to say that there's a movement gravitating towards more race consciousness for people of all racial backgrounds, it would seem like, especially among whites, this is becoming very noticeable, right? And there's actually social science research that can attest to this. So I'm not sure exactly where in the long-term spectrum we are, but this is certainly a movement that's built off of other movements as well. So we shouldn't forget that either.
I want to pick up on the title of the book, Stay Woke. It's become a sort of maybe a cliche these days to talk about being woke. And one may imagine that if you get behind this idea that Black Lives Matter, that you got it, that you understand how race and racism works. But of course, then you wouldn't need to write a guidebook about it. What is the intention for your book? Who is your intended audience?
Well, admittedly, we have, I think, a number of audiences that we're trying to speak to, and that had made the writing of the book sometimes challenging. But we do have people who are pretty informed about a lot of things. And at the same time, I would say that they might not know how to implement that knowledge. They might not think about how do you put that knowledge to political work. How does one organize with this knowledge, right? How do you prioritize the local versus the national? And then there's also elements of our book where we're speaking to the people who might think that they are quite woke, right? And that, and then to kind of temper, to curb the woker than thou-itis, right? That there is, it's actually not helpful to try to shame people who you think have less knowledge than you, right? Rather, let's use, you know, our conversations with other people as ways to bring them into the fold, right? And to create more space for dialogue that can be critical, right? And courageous. So that's one of our aims. Another aim, though, is for people who really don't know a lot about race. A lot of people who are nervous about talking about race because it's such prickly territory, and it's especially so for white Americans, who even the most well-meaning are really concerned about stepping on other people's toes, saying things that, you know, might not be appreciated. They don't, you know, they're trying to navigate. And so we're also, you know, holding out, you know, a guide to those folks too. And we have an entire chapter in which we dedicate towards talking about terms. It's called All the Words We Throw Around. And so it's trying to create some common ground for us to talk across.
So let's talk about the structural racism that it's certainly good to get a handle on when we're describing why it's important for us to say Black lives need to matter. The idea Black lives matter is implicitly alluding to the fact that today in our current society, Black lives don't matter as much to society as they ought to. They ought to matter as much as everyone else's lives. And so how do you point out in the book ways for people to talk about structural racism? It's one thing to say, here's all these documented incidents of violence that police and others wreak on Black people. You can sort of dismiss that as anecdotal, even though, of course, there's plenty of studies proving it. But what about the broader issue of systemic racism when it comes to such mundane seeming things like housing or just wealth or college education, or access to college education?
Right. Thank you for that question. So I was actually just talking to some of my students about this. And I think what's really helpful is, like, so when we talk about racism, when the word racism is used, it seems as though people immediately start talking about bigotry, animus, you know, epithets, how this person treated this other person. That is very important. I mean, like, I think we have experience with racism in those ways, and they're very visceral. Structural racism, that concept is to kind of illuminate how various institutions in our lives are shaped, how rather they shape our lives and our life chances. So structural racism or systemic racism is really a concept about disparities between groups, right? And in really predictable ways. So when we talk about we could talk about policing and the criminal justice system. There's lots of examples of how this happens, right? The way that Black and Brown communities, right, are policed so much more heavily, under so much more surveillance by police, right? And in doing so, Black and Brown people get stopped much more often. And then it leads to a whole other chain of events in which people of color, particularly Black people, are disproportionately put through the, you know, the stages of, you know, search and seizure, arrest, conviction, and then sentencing. Like, these are all these, they all become very disparate measures. These are much more punitive, right, for Black people. So that's one way to think about structural racism. Another is to think about how our schools are funded and, you know, how much money is being spent per pupil. That there's a kind of structural violence or kind of structural racism that is targeted towards people of color, particularly, again, Black people, in which they get the short end of the stick on the redistribution or the distribution of resources, right? We could even talk about health, right? There is a structural racism to, you know, when we talk about the youngest of us, right? Why is it that Black babies are 2 to 3 more times more likely than white babies to die in their first year of life? I mean, we can even control for things like health insurance, right? And even economic class of the mothers. And there is this disparity, right? So this is a way of looking at the way that people's lives and the quality of their lives are shaped because of the institutions, the policies, the practices.
There's also this very persistent myth in the United States that we live in a meritocracy, no matter how much, especially on the right, no matter how much evidence exists to the contrary. How do you lay out The idea of, or how do you make the case for the structural racism that Black people experience in the United States, that shows, that lays bare, this myth of a meritocracy?
Right. Meritocracy is a really important concept for us, and we tackle it throughout the book. And in some regard, right, like there's a reason why we value it as a society. Meritocracy is this idea that it's by somebody's individual efforts and they're by their talents, by their individuality that we measure their contributions and their place, right? And in some regard, that effort to make meritocracy important in our country was probably in some regard to push back against corruption, nepotism, and but there's a way that in which this has gone way too far, right? And when meritocracy starts to justify these racial disparities that I was kind of referring to earlier, this is a major problem. It's also not to say, right, that we shouldn't all work hard at the things that we're passionate about, or that to try to undercut somebody's efforts that they've made in their life, right? But what we are saying is that there is a way that, if we take all things into account, people from every racial group are really, they're really working quite hard. A lot of people are working really hard to make the ends meet. Why white Americans have better life chances doesn't have anything to do with their intrinsic worth being better, or they're harder workers, right? We're seeing over and over again in like an intergenerational way, a transference of wealth, that some people being born on third base, right, while some people are just trying to get to first. That when people are start off in life with different circumstances, like how then do we assess meritocracy, right? So when you talk about all the ways intergenerationally that Black people in this country have been dealt some of the worst hands, it's really disingenuous to talk about, equal opportunity if you're not starting out with the youngest people in society having the same things, the
Right.
same resources.
And to the credit of Black Lives Matter, we actually have a conversation in this country today around reparations, so much so that presidential candidates are being asked whether they support it or not, and several say they do. And that is pretty remarkable in suggesting that our understanding has gone a long way forward. I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier in your book, which is called Stay Woke: A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. That you have a section on terminology, your chapter, all the words people throw around. And, in it, you, of course, have some basic concepts like affirmative action, even capitalism, which I thought was a great word to bring into a book about racism. But I wanted to hone in on anti-racism, which, of course, is not the same as being not racist. Can you explain why?
We, along with other people, are really trying to advance as much as possible the idea that being an anti-racist is an action, right? It's something that you're doing, and it's not so much about, right, who we are. Like, we've been focusing so much on the idea that being a racist or an anti-racist is a thing that people are, like in like their self, right, in their mind, in their heart. And we're really trying to push this idea that racism and anti-racism are things that people do or participate in. And so when we are anti-racist, we are actively confronting racist ideologies. We are actively confronting interpersonal practices of how, right, how people get treated. And we are actively, trying to take a stand on the way that the decisions are made in kind of a governmental way, whether that be at the local level or the national level. It could be right in your workplace, it could be in your church, but the kind of way that we govern ourselves, right? So to be an anti-racist is an act.
I want to talk about intersectionality. The subtitle of your book, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter, indicates that, we, of course, do perhaps focus on some Black lives more than others. There's a lot of focus on Black men because, of course, they are disproportionately targeted more than any other demographic by police. But how important is it to focus on Black women? Black transgender women, Black transgender people in general, Black immigrants, immigrants, which we don't talk enough about, all of these other identities that intersect with being Black in America.
Right, absolutely. I mean, when we're, intersectionality is not just about thinking about the idea that we have multiple identities, right? That, you know, I am Mexican American and I am biracial and I'm a woman and I'm a PhD and all these things. No, intersectionality is about thinking about the power dynamics of those identities and how in particular contexts, those identities with power either can create more opportunities or restrict them. They create more power or restricts it. And so when we think about people who in most contexts of their lives or in contexts in which they're, you know, with people who they've never met before, right? Which is really where, you know, a lot of kind of danger comes into our lives. Not all, right? But like when you're dealing with the police and you've never met this police officer before, one's identity, their phenotype, how they present really does affect like how they're going to be treated, we think, right? And so if we think about people who are living in the margins within the margins, it's the people who live within the margins who we do need to keep our eye on. Some people think that that's really like all too specific. Well, isn't this a really small group? Sure, numerically, but what it means when the person who's the marginalized of the marginalized, when that person knows freedom, when that person is safe, when that person's contributions are valued, it makes it better for everybody. It secures safety for everybody, right? It changes the paradigm. And so that's why it's important to talk about, you know, things like transgender bathrooms, right? Some people treat that like this niche issue. It's an issue of safety. It's an issue of rights. And when more people's rights are secured, right? Like, I mean, I think there's a rippling effect here.
What are we supposed to be working towards? Let's talk about the world we want to live in, because that's something, unfortunately, that's often left out of our conversations when we talk about the things that are wrong with our society. Do you describe in your book what it means to live in, I mean, I'm sort of hesitant to use this term post-racial because it was what was used to describe the country when President Obama was elected, because we never thought that America could ever elect a Black man. And of course, we know now that there was no such thing as 2008 being a moment of post-racism in America. But still, what could a truly post-racial America look like?
Well, a post-racist is what is a thing that we're thinking about more, right? A post-racist America is an America in which those racial disparities that I spoke about earlier in our interview, these disparities of health, the disparities of education, of wealth, income, of the way that justice is dealt out, when those disparities no longer exist, that is what we think a post-racist society will start to look like. You know, if we can imagine that, that is the goal. And now some people say, well, what about the way that, you know, we individually treat each other, the way we socialize with each other? Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of my concern. But I think it makes it, I think what's more germane to the conversation of like idea of being racist or post-racist society is about those disparities. Is our life course not determined anymore by our race? And so we, in thinking about that as a goal, we do encourage our readers to dream big. I mean, there's different strategies for how we could approach this. And you could take a real conservative, pragmatic strategy to all of this. I think this is the time for bold ideas. And Candace thinks this is the time for bold ideas. And so
your co-author, Candace Watt-Smith,
with a affirmation of dreaming big. Would you mind if I read that?
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead. Not at all.
The last affirmation of our book reads, dream big. If humane treatment is the foundation on which we build our government, what would our society look like if we dared to dream big? Everyone would wake up in an affordable home. and the kids would go to school to get a relevant, effective, and engaging education. It wouldn't really matter which neighborhood you lived in, because the public schools are equally funded, the teachers are well paid, and the free after-school programs are a fun place to be. If a parent is a little late picking up a kid, the child doesn't worry that she or he will get choked, shot, or deported by the law enforcement. The parent was just having one too many laughs with an interracial social network at her or his living wage job. Tonight's dinner is another nutritious meal with vegetables from the town farm half a mile away, and that clean glass of water from the tap washes it down nicely. After eating, people promenade around the neighborhood to let their food settle and get caught up on the latest scoop. The older woman down the street has been diagnosed with breast cancer, but thankfully they caught it early during her yearly mammogram, covered under universal health care. The 19-year-old who graduated from high school last year is visiting his family for the weekend. He's been working at a wind farm as part of a national program that will pay for a single year of college for each year of service. It's election week, and some folks are casting their ballots tonight, but those who have other commitments are voting tomorrow or in the next few days. Two women candidates are going head-to-head again this year. One wants to build more bridges across the border with Mexico, while the other would rather expedite the conversion of our federal prison properties into job training centers for the environmentally sustainable economy. This will be a tough choice. The night sky grows darker, but since it's safe outside, people stay out a little longer to watch the stars come out. The sky is clear and the air is clean. Pop, 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 pop. No one ducks, but all look up. Fireworks are going off over City Hall. It's Harriet Tubman's birthday, and the sparkles overhead light up the faces down below. Tears well up in the eyes of the elders. They remember a time when fewer people knew her name and how she risked her life to liberate others. We carry her spirit with us a little more these days because we're attributing greater value to what we share with others and are less concerned with what we can accumulate and keep for ourselves. As we make our way home to turn in for the night, we pull our hoodies over our heads to ward off the evening chill. We feel safe in our skin. We feel safe in our country, and freedom and justice are for all.
Okay, you officially made me cry. Wow. Thank you. Thank you for reading that. That was very, very powerful. Even before you talk about tears rolling down, there were tears rolling down my eyes. Well, that's a great note to end on, and I'm going to go and have a sob in the corner. Tehema, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Thank you so much.
My guest has been Tehema Lopez-Bunyasi, Assistant Professor of Conflict Analysis and Resolution at George Mason University. We've been discussing the book that she's co-authored with Candace Watts-Smith called Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.